Right, and it is that time of the morning where we cross live to the UK to speak to Gavin Gray for the UK Report. Good morning, Gavin.
Good morning to you, SJ. How are you?
I'm all right. I've got a bit of the sniffles, but I'm all right. You know how it goes. we move through it. Right. We start with news from the Middle East, or rather from the UK, potentially to the Middle East, as British troops could be deployed on the ground in Gaza as part of aid missions there.
That's right. So the American forces had been saying that they were looking to set up a floating bridge onto the beach, a sort of floating causeway, in order that ships with aid, food, medications, etc., for the people of Gaza could actually be delivered. Because one of the big issues is they have said continually there will be no US troops on the ground, as it were. There'll be no boots on the ground. So the question is, how is it going to get off the ships and onto the beach? Well, I think we now have an answer. The Americans were saying this would be done by, quote, a substantial third party who will drive the trucks along this floating causeway. We now are hearing that this is likely to be British troops. Hopefully, when the aid corridor opens next month, it is thought now that the British troops will perform that task. Obviously, there is not, this is not without an element of risk in that aid convoys have been hit before, haven't they? And British people are among a number of different nations who have lost their charitable workers when they've been caught in accidental fire from the Israeli Defense Forces. So the focus is on trying, I think now, SJ, if this does go ahead, and I think it is pretty likely to go ahead, on how to keep them as secure as possible. You would have thought, wouldn't you, you know, that's where the aid is coming in, that's the floating pontoon, that's the beach, so we'd better not fire at that, you know, area. But of course, it's not just the Israeli Defense Forces here, it's also Hamas that are involved. And apparently negotiations are tricky, to say the least. And so it is thought that this is likely to go ahead. And on Wednesday, a United Nations team, even this week, the United Nations team had to take cover when mortars landed near the planned distribution zone. And so that's why these negotiations are so fraught and it is so difficult. But it does look like the British troops will be on the ground, just not in a fighting mechanism.
Gavin, tell us about this threat to UK universities, a warning issued by the head of MI5.
Yeah, interesting this. So 24 leading universities were invited to a meeting in the centre of London. When they got there, there was a sort of bit of a lecture from MI5, the security services. And MI5 were basically warning these top universities, among them, incidentally, the University of Oxford, the University of Cambridge and Imperial College London. Basically, they were warned that cutting edge research could be targeted by state to boost their own militaries and economies. Now, at no point did anyone mention the word China, but that was quite clearly one of those countries, along with Russia, I think, that were being accused of spying. As you'll know, over previous weeks, we've been reporting on people being arrested on spying charges, both here and in Germany and elsewhere in Europe. And it has, I'm afraid, continued to be a number of accusations crisscrossing in what appears to be almost a cold war relating to the theft of or stealing of data. And what MI5 was saying is, look, universities, you need to be much more clued up on this, that you could be doing a research project. And without really knowing, somebody who is spying for China could be part of your group. And so consequently, it looks like these new processes are to come in, which will involve the transparency of funding, because obviously you want to know precisely who is funding your research on this, but also key university personnel being given security clearance, special security clearance. And I think those two measures will help with this. But arguably, I think it is going to get much, much tougher working in those research fields, getting your security cleared.
I am fascinated by this next story. And I mean, we have to, you know, we're in sort of election mode and listening to all the promises of the various parties here. But this is quite a promise by the Labour Party that says that it's pledging to make public or bring back the UK rail system into public ownership within 5 years if it gets into power. Really?
Yes, they are. Now, for those who may remember British Rail in those heady days of rail travel decades ago, you'll think, what on earth would that achieve? Because towards the end, the running of the trains was not good. However, SJ, I have to tell you, some of the private companies have also been labeled as being pretty awful as well. And I think the way the privatization was initially handled by the UK government of the day wasn't very clever either, in that the tracks are run by one organization, a lot of the land and stations are operated by another, and then the trains are operated by other companies. And indeed, it's not just one or two. I think it's about 10 to 12 different train companies. So if you're doing a train journey across the UK, you're then sometimes having to go on, you know, two or three different operators, train operators. So it is complicated. And what the Labour Party are saying is, we're not going to have to buy these services back and pay the companies off, because these are all done on contracts. And all we're going to do is to wait for the individual contracts to finish and expire, and then we will run them. Now, of course, people have mixed feelings about nationalized the railways. Sometimes it seems to work well. In other countries, it doesn't. There will be lots of people, though, SJ, looking at the ticket prices here, which over the last couple of years have really, really gone up. And I come into the centre of London from only about 50 kilometres away. And I did it a couple of times last week. And along with my parking, it came to about 1,000 South African rand.
Sure. No, I mean, that's, you know, I haven't been to the, back to the UK for a really long time. But when I did go back, you know, that I would use the train, and I have an app that links my, you know, my banking app, and it would tell me once I put my card in, it would tell me how much I've just paid for a ticket to head into central London from sort of the from Surrey, which is where I was staying, and nearly had a heart attack. So. Okay. Well. Interesting. I have to admit, I've not really been following the sort of election build up, but I don't know what Labour's chances are. I must probably get my hat back, not into the ring, but get my hat back on and see what's going on that side. We go en français now, and Emmanuel Macron, who's made quite an alarmist speech, threatening that warning that Europe can die. What? Why?
Yes. Well, he's basically saying that he believes that the European Union is rather naive about how the rest of the world operates. And he says this is a very fast changing world. He says Europe needs to be lucid and recognize that Europe is mortal. He said, quote, it can die. It all depends on the choices we make, and those choices need to be made now. Now, what was he referring to? Well, already he has suggested that French troops could be sent to Ukraine. He believes Russia must be defeated with its war in Ukraine and indeed driven out of Crimea. Now, when he said that, all the other European nations quickly said, well, there won't be troops from our country going in, et cetera, et cetera. But here's the thought. America will not fund this war against Russia in Ukraine forever and ever and ever. And they have only really just passed the latest round of money budget. And of course, Donald Trump has already said that he is unlikely to continue funding the war in Ukraine. Now, if that happens, this war is right on the doorstep of Europe. And I think what Emmanuel Macron is saying, look, Europe needs to step up to the plate here much more if we're going to be, you know, trying to protect what's happening on our doorstep. So that's one thing. He's also saying that the competition from America and China really risk leaving the EU, quote, marginalized and relegated. In other words, he does believe in business that the EU is going to have to get much tougher with its negotiations over international trade.
Interesting one. All right. We are moving to cider now, rather the UK's largest cider maker, which is Heineken. Didn't know that, but they own Bulmers Cider. They have levelled a cider orchard, an apple orchard, the size of 140 football pitches. For why? Why have they done that?
Well, because they say cider drinking has plummeted in the UK, and they're saying we don't need these apples anymore. Instead, they're going to buy apples from, as it were, farms and freelance farmers rather than have their own. But it has led to absolute consternation. So giving you a number of acres or hectares doesn't mean very much to a lot of people. So I've calculated it out, and the area that has been completely cleared of these beautiful apple trees is the size of 140 full-size football pitches. And this was cleared over just the space of a couple of days in Monmouthshire, west of England. And now Heineken is to sell the land, saying this surplus of apples and a slowdown in demand for cider is the reason they have uprooted thousands of trees. And incidentally, these trees were not new. They were planted in 1997. They didn't need permission for it. They have done nothing wrong, to be clear. But environmentalists have gone up the wall saying these trees were really important, particularly for one species called the wintering thrush. And that's sort of, they use the autumn berries and so forth, and they move on to wind-blown apple crops later on. And they say chopping down this large orchard is an absolute crime. They really think it's just so sad. And indeed, I suppose it is. But as I said, Heineken were reacting entirely within the law. It wasn't a specially preserved field. And they say, I'm afraid that's the way they've had to do, is that, you know, they are a business. They say with fewer people drinking cider, they simply don't need all those extra apples.
My late dad used to love a cider. One of my memories of childhood is sitting in a pub garden and being allowed a little sip of my dad's cider. Loved a bit of cider. Right, to Norway now. And now I get to use one of my favourite words, which I don't get to use very often, but archipelago. Absolutely love that word. A tourist who's visited the Norwegian Arctic archipelago of Svalbard has been fined just under £1,000 for getting too close to a walrus. That seems like a foolish manoeuvre.
It seems like a stupid manoeuvre in the first time. It's also, incidentally, illegal. It is against the law to approach the wildlife of Svalbard, which is this Norwegian Arctic archipelago, and disturb the wildlife. And I'm afraid video has emerged of a tourist getting onto an ice floe, which I wouldn't have fancied doing in the first place, then actually approaching this massive walrus. Yes, people were recording it, and they just think, you know, apart from being dangerous, it's also obviously not good for the wildlife. So the governor there encouraging everyone to keep a good distance from walruses. They say they are, dangerous. They can be very grumpy animals, apparently. They became protected back in 1952 when, it really became very clear only a few hundred remained of what were hundreds of thousands. Just three centuries ago, they became, of course, the target of heavy commercial exploitation. So that's why they're being protected. But along with other wildlife up there, polar bears, seals, whales, reindeer, Arctic foxes, you know, stay away. But that seems a really hefty fine, doesn't it? Roughly 20,000 South African rand for getting too close to a walrus.
It does, and it doesn't, Gavin, in that I'm looking here that an adult male in the Pacific, an adult male walrus can weigh more than 2,000 kilograms. That's wild to me. My reason being, and presuming that this person is, you know, is has all his faculties, because I know that sometimes in these situations, the people who kind of end up in, you know, lion cages or whatever, are sometimes have some mental health issues going on. Assuming that's not the case here, what a bloody stupid thing to do, because all that needs to happen now is that this animal takes against somebody wandering into his habitat, savagely brutalizes him or kills him, and then there's a whole, he ends up getting shot or something. So, I mean, I understand why the penalty does have to be high, because the minute you start interfering in the habitat of a creature and you come a cropper, then there's a whole rescue operation that has to be done to save you or to, you know. So I'm afraid that I'm entirely with this. I just, why are people so stupid? It's like recently I saw pictures of people disturbing buffalo in Canada and wildebeest, and they're getting up close, and then the wildebeest turn on them, and you can see them running for their lives. I think, in what world, you know, why are you doing that? Can't you just admire from afar? You know, this is not our environment. And then the animal does what the animal does because it feels that it's, you know, it's having to defend itself. And then, you know, so actually when an animal comes out on top, I'm all right with it, I have to say. And that's probably not a terribly appropriate thing to say necessarily, but that's how I feel. That's how I feel about it. Ah, now, UK online shopping is winding down. Which surprises me, actually, but this is a kind of post-COVID winding down, isn't it?
That's right. But it's interesting because I think all the supermarkets in the UK were actually keen to build on the success of online shopping during the pandemic. But it appears people aren't quite so keen. So Sainsbury's, which is the second largest supermarket chain here in the UK, had online sales of 20% or nearer 25% at the pandemic. So £1 in 4, as it were, was being spent with online shopping. But that's now slipped to 13% or £1 in 8. And, you know, it's a really odd change. So why is that, particularly when they're constantly doing deals for you to go online and to do the shopping there? But it's an interesting aspect of their latest set of figures about profit and loss, etc., that actually people are now wanting to go back into the stores to choose their own veg. I suppose that's for some people what it is. I always like to see the veg and the fruit and, you know, how ripe it is and what it looks like, etc. But also, I think partially socially as well. I think some people in this country absolutely love going out shopping. I know there will be lots of people going, oh, lucky them.
Yeah.
But, it is something that I think gets some people together. I know I often see people in supermarkets and they're not shopping, they're just having a good chat with one another. So I think perhaps socially there is that change. Either way, it does appear that it is on the way down. No signs of an improvement. The question is, where will it drop as far as, you know, as far down as when the supermarkets are trying their best to raise numbers?
It's interesting to me. My online shopping did increase. My grocery online shopping increased during COVID. And then I think I was so relieved when the restrictions started getting lifted. I was so relieved to be back out that I don't actually use an online shopping for groceries anymore. But I've got friends who do it religiously now. They can't think of anything worse than going out. And I actually don't mind it. And you know, a lot of my friends who've also got young children say, what, you take your young kids shopping? I have to be honest, mine are pretty good. I, you know, put one of them in the trolley, the other one sort of follows around, and it's not too tragic. But I know if your kids aren't as terribly well behaved as mine, I can imagine that it's hideous. But it's interesting to me that there's been a dip because, yeah, as you say, I would have thought that we would have, it's not something I would have thought we'd have backpedaled on because of the convenience factor. But as you say, some people like going around and squeezing an avocado, don't they? I'm
absolutely
one of them.
But I would also say, SJ, and I'm going to embarrass you now, of course, your children beautifully behaved, and because they've been taught that way, whereas I do see children ripping stuff off the shelf and opening it.
No.
And starting to eat it, and you think, hang on a minute, you've not even bought it yet, you know. And,
That's so funny.
I would struggle to work as a checkout person, I really would.
Oh, I would as well. I mean, yeah, listen, you say that, but I wonder if mine are just under the threat of don't you dare misbehave. I don't know. Gavin, thank you very much indeed. We will chat to you again next week. The time's 9:30, time for your sport.
Week.
Thanks, Gigi.